Peggy and Lynn, and just our normal housekeeping, and that is anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please turn it off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And also with us is Rosie and Rosette, who welcomes your contribution for acronyms. I think that probably the house got out late today. It seems as if they're running a little longer than normal. And I'm sure that the senators, when they get the message that I've already started, will start making their way down. With that, Lynn, you may go ahead and proceed. We're into detailed budget presentation. And Peggy was doing an outstanding job, even if she didn't know about AARP yesterday. Judy, about AARP yesterday. See, I had a memory lapse as well. All right, Judy.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I'm the manager for the Analysis and Evaluation Unit in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And for the record, just to clarify, I was immediately instructed on what AARP was upon my return to the office, and as I discovered, it is not an acronym.
No.
So my effort to try to not say an acronym was in vain. So,
Judy, I think the best part of it is that you haven't reached that magical age.
That's right, where it just comes automatically, yes. We are actually starting on the document on page 78. That's where we ended off yesterday. We'll start at the top of that page. And just the general point that this particular page demonstrates is that the people on the Oregon Health Plan tend to have much more serious health conditions. They tend to be have more chronically ill people, et cetera. They are less healthy for a variety of reasons. For example, the diabetes rate is twice the prevalence rate than the general population. The general population's rate tends to be around 5% for the adult population, and in the Oregon Health Plan, that rate is around 11%. And for asthma, again, it's twice the prevalence rate than the general population. The estimations for people suffering from asthma is approximately 7.7% in the general population. And in the Oregon Health Plan population, it's approximately 15%. HIV/AIDS, the estimation in working with the HIV program is that we cover approximately 40% of all people living with HIV/AIDS. And again, as noted earlier, the prevalence rate for children with special health care needs tends to be around 20 to 25%, and in the general population, it tends to be around 10%. As Lynn mentioned earlier, we have instituted a disease management program, and it is for fee-for-service clients, and it focuses on individuals who have diabetes, asthma, or congestive heart failure. And we also have instituted a case management program, and this would be for individuals also in fee-for-service with high utilization and high costs. The next table is on managed care enrollment. And that has been important for us for a variety of reasons. This outlines some of the reasons as to why we like to promote access to managed health care. And the reason is that they tend to have greater access to care and better outcomes. Some of these rates here, these are from national screening rates, is that breast cancer screening tends to be much higher than in fee-for-service. Children's access to their primary care providers is much higher, and well-child visits is higher, as well as the receipt of a dental visit. The next chart is the chart on managed care, and that shows the percent of people enrolled in managed care. Here I'd like to clarify this includes both those fully capitated health plans like Kaiser or Docs, yes, another one, as well as the primary care case management program. And that makes up only a few percentage points here. Our high was in 1997. Our low here is in 2001. We do not have a figure yet for 2003. However, it has dropped again. In particular, it's related to many plans dropping out of serving OHP 2 standard individuals. There are four plans at the present time who are not serving standard, and there are 10 plans who are serving standard. That is in a lot of flux right now, and we will not know how that plays out. Many plans are waiting till the new biennium to figure out whether the OHP standard will have the prescription drug benefit. Without the prescription drug benefit, several of the plans are not sure that they will continue to cover OHP standard. Our target was at one time to try to raise our managed care enrollment up to 79% by 2005. And again, we would like to revise that target based on whether the managed health care plans continue to serve the OHP standard population or not. We've seen a decline from its height of 25% to its lowest point, and at the present time it's dropped about 18% from its height. And that concludes those particular sections.
Program growth. Thank you, Judy.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I'm Lynn Reed, Administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and replacing Judy at the table will be Jim Edge to walk through the next section of the document.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Jim Edge. I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm going to go through the next few pages about program growth and budget growth in the Oregon Health Plan, starting with the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994. And this first page, page 81 of our Medicaid 101 document, has the various legislative approved actions that have occurred over the years since the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan. Starting in February of 1994, Medicaid was expanded to include most Oregonians under 100% of the federal poverty level if they met the other eligibility criteria. Then in January of 1995, elderly, disabled, children in foster care were added to the Oregon Health Plan, along with chemical dependency benefits, and part of the mental health benefits were added for this population. In July of 97, the remainder of the mental health benefits were added. In January of 1988,
Jim?
Yes.
Who were the 25% under in 1995, the 25% of population that was added to mental health benefits?
Madam Chair, since Jim wasn't here, then I'll step in. It was a particular geographic area that was covered, and I believe, actually Barry probably is the best person here to answer that. I believe it did include the Portland metropolitan area, but it just picked up about a fourth of the population, allowed for an opportunity for that program to phase in, to see how it worked before bringing on the rest of the population.
So it carved out 25% of the...
Right. 25% moved over to the OHP prioritized list of benefit packages and the managed care delivery system.
Okay. In January of 1988, the Pell Grant eligible college students were added, and if you have students in college, you know that the Pell Grant requires low-income family income for eligibility. In March of 1998, pregnant women coverage was expanded from 133% of the federal poverty level to 170% of the federal poverty level. This is the group that on previous charts you've seen listed as PLM, or poverty level medical. In July of 1988, the Children's Health Insurance Program was added, and that expanded coverage for children under age 19 up to 170% of the federal poverty level. In April of 2002, the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program was implemented, and in February of 2003, the Oregon Health
Plan... I believe that's about, 105? That's a small population group.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
That's a very small population group, yes.
Your chair was kind of pivotal in that particular piece of legislation. Big story behind that one.
Mm-hmm.
In February of 2003, Oregon Health Plan 2 was implemented, and the expansion that occurred at that time was the pregnant women coverage expanded from 170% of the federal poverty level to 185, and also the Children's Health Insurance Program was expanded from 170 to 185. And the OHP standard population, which was originally intended to expand at that time, did not.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. And with that expansion of the CHIP coverage, what percentage of the eligibles are now covered?
I don't know the answer to that, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley. Do you know, Lynn?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I don't know precisely the number. I know that when we were doing modeling for the program, we assumed that if we met our participation rate, which I believe for the CHIP program at this higher income level, we're expecting about 1,200 clients to participate. And so far, I think since we just started in February, we're around 500. So we're quickly moving up. And that if that 1,200 participated, we thought that would be about 95% of the child population eligible for coverage.
And, Madam Chair, is it possible to come back to us with a more definitive answer that tells us how many of the eligibles are in fact covered?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, we can do that because this modeling was done on an earlier population survey group, and I think there would be more up-to-date information against which we could measure. This will probably take a little bit of time to put that together.
Thank you. Madam Chair, what I'm getting at here is just wanting to capture what is the remaining need. That information will help us in a further discussion of our priorities. Thank you.
Okay, on the next page of the document, page 82, there are some other factors listed there that contribute to budget growth, one of them being medical inflation, which traditionally over many years has run higher than other consumer inflation. Delivery system composition, and by that we mean things such as more expensive technology in the delivery system. For example, we're not just taking x-rays to look into tissue anymore. We're doing magnetic imaging and things like that that is more expensive technology. Caseload growth, which unfortunately in Oregon tends to be higher in economic downturn situations, and so we're seeing more caseload growth.
That's not unique to Oregon, I would think.
Madam Chair, you're right. That's not unique to Oregon. State and federal policy changes, that being in many cases new programs that have been added to the Oregon Health Plan. Some of the changes in budget over time are in the charts on the following pages. And if you turn to page 83, you'll see the expenditure history from the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan in terms of total funds. And you see that that's a pretty steady growth line from $1.9 billion in the 95-97 biennium, growing up to $3.5 billion approximately in the 2001-03 biennium, and then the 2003-05 governor's balanced budget. If you remember, that's based on the January governor's balanced budget. That included an assumption that the reductions that were taken during 2001-03 for cost savings would be included, that there would be no inflation included, that adult dental was removed. And we understand that that may not be the way the Oregon Health Plan is funded exactly in the 2003-05 biennium, but this is the governor's balanced budget from January that was used to develop this figure.
Well, the 2001-03 figures, does that also include those actions? There was actions taken after 2001-03. How would that change that figure?
Um, That does include some phase-out of programs that occurred during the biennium. So there have been some increases and some decreases during the biennium. And the total you see here is the total for the biennium after both increases and caseload increases and program decreases as a result of legislative actions.
So, Mr. Brady.
Just a thought. Madam Chair, is your question, what would the addition of 5548 do? I think we added standard prescription drugs back. It wasn't a huge amount. All told, I believe 5548 was on the order of $33 million, but I would think that the lion's share of that went into the senior program. But with respect to OMAP, we're talking about prescription drugs for the standard population, medically needy at about $1 million for a state-funded program, and maybe some more, but those are the two that come to mind. So
I think it's a two-part question because you had whether or not the 5,100 pieces in the 103 figure, and whether or not the 5,548 what that then made the numbers. So you've got those two legislative acts, those two actions that would change, could alter this position, this figure.
Madam Chair, we can verify that and get back to you with that. The next page, page 84, shows the trend over the same period of time looking just at general funds. And you'll see that this isn't the same gradual increase, and there's a couple of reasons for that. You'll notice a dip in the 97-99 figure. That's the year that some tobacco tax was put in the Oregon Health Plan that replaced some of the general fund. And then in the 0103, there's a dip there again, and that's the biennium when tobacco tax and tobacco settlement money was placed in the Oregon Health Plan, and that's why you don't see the same trend going up every biennium in this chart. Otherwise, it would, but it's because of those other funds that are placed in there.
And here again, just to complete the expenditure picture, to include those actions that were taken with both 5100 and 5548.
Madam Chair, we'll do that. Next page, page 85, is a graph of caseload over time. If you look at this at the same five biennia and look at the at total caseload over time, you see that at the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan, probably partly because of the publicity about the plan in the first biennium, the caseload was 395,000. It dipped a little bit in the next biennium, but since then has been showing a gradual increase over time. Page 86 shows some of the same information, but in a pie chart format. And the top pie chart is total funds. Shows that 95% of the funding OHP, that 1% of it is the Children's Health Insurance Program, and that about 4% of it is the what's called the non-OHP, primarily the qualified Medicare beneficiaries in that group. But then when you look at that at the bottom pie chart and look at general funds, the composition changes just a little bit. You don't see CHIP at all in the bottom pie chart. Children's Health Insurance Program, not CHIP, because that's funded with tobacco tax on the state side. And so the non-Oregon Health Plan takes a little bigger chunk of that pie chart. And then the final budget chart is on page 87. And probably what you're most interested in there is looking at the grade lines. If you look across the page at the first grade line, which shows the 0103 legislative adopted budget, which is a total of $3.2 billion, and then breaks it out by components if you want to look across and see the general fund, tobacco settlement, other fund, and federal fund. The next grade line is what would have happened if we had projected into the 0305 biennium using a current service level concept, which we, of course, are not going to do. But in that case, it would have grown to $4.6 billion. And then that bottom grade line across the bottom there is the 0305 governor's balance budget figure. And you see the $2.977 billion, which matched the chart you saw earlier. The general fund component of that, the other fund component, which is tobacco tax and other funds, and the federal fund component of that. That's a summary of budget, and Lynn is going to talk about the future of the American Health Plan.
I just want to do a wrap-up, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Knowing that there is a lot more work to be done in terms of where, how the future for the Oregon Health Plan plays out. In terms of that future, one of your tasks, of course, is to determine what the priority objectives are for the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid. The questions that are there revolve around, making the program sustainable, access to care, is improved health a priority, increased accountability, using evidence-based medicine, increased provider capacity and infrastructure. Those are some of the priorities that you may be looking at. And in terms of how you answer those questions, moving on to page 89, that'll frame the decisions made around who should be eligible, what benefits should be provided, what kind of cost sharing should accompany those benefits, what provider payment levels are appropriate, how should the public and private components of the Oregon Health Plan interact. How much funding is needed, how much funding is reasonable, and from what fund sources will that come? The hard work, of course, is yours. We did look in terms of prioritizing options for that future program. The governor's balanced budget has really served to establish a resource level to work within. And, of course, that's been further reduced by later revenue forecasts. We did provide in the official Ways and Means document as Appendix A a prioritized list that works within the governor's balanced budget. And what that prioritized list does is just a prioritization of eligibility groups, knowing that other work is underway to look at this from a different perspective. And that particular document prioritized as highest mandatory Medicaid populations, the optional pregnant women and their newborns, followed by the Children's Health Insurance Program, then the OHP standard adults with children in the household, OHP standard adults without children in the household, followed up with the breast and cervical cancer program. The kinds of principles that we utilized in terms of coming up with that simple categorization were, as a number one a principle, wanting to protect the vulnerable, although all of these populations are vulnerable. And moving on from there, that what we needed to do was make sure that our prioritization reflected choices that would allow us to draw down federal funds so that we could maximize the amount of money available to protect those vulnerable populations. That it was important to maximize healthy birth outcomes, and that it was also important to have healthy children, that they're better able to learn and to contribute to society as they mature and if they've had a healthy start in life. Healthy parents are important to a child's well-being, and then obviously, vulnerable persons. Moving on to page 91, with that only being one prioritized list, significant work has been done by the House Audit and Human Services Budget Reform Committee, two members of which are on this committee who aren't here right now. I don't intend to present their recommendations, but just comment that they include a base plan that would include mandatory Medicaid services for mandatory Medicaid populations, and then look at adding some optional services for that mandatory population, identifying ways in which costs can be constrained in order to afford those two higher priorities, and then looking at considering additional populations. Now, there are other groups that are working on additional priorities. The governor will have some additional priorities that will be presented. Other legislative committees and, of course, legislative leadership and the co-chairs will move forward with the priorities that they believe should play out.
Lynn, when do you anticipate that the governor's priorities will be available?
Madam Chair, I can speak, I guess, briefly to that. The governor is working through that even as we speak today, working through those issues and deciding exactly what he wants to lay out. So I don't say he does not have a time frame for that yet. We've been shooting for this week or next, but that really is going to be his call, Madam Chair.
With this committee beginning to being pressed by the co-chairs to begin to put, some priority input into their decision, and it's the hope of this chair that we will try to work and coordinate as much as possible so that we're kind of somewhat in sync as we go through this process in the beginning. I think, that was true when we set the work groups up that include myself and Representative Wesson and Bates and others, of recognizing that hopefully we can come out with some kind of, so it would be helpful for me if, as soon as the governor can, to let us, as he gets his work done, to input that to us. It's very helpful if we've got some framework with what he's proposing.
Message received, Madam Chair.
I just want to turn to page 92. One of the things that we've been asked to address was what kind of outcomes you could expect with our program in the next biennium. Well, that one's rather difficult for the Oregon Health Plan right now, as it is, I assume, for other programs. Those outcomes will depend upon how the program gets reconfigured and where the trade-offs are made. It's expected that with limited resources that there will be trade-offs, of course, the program that's designed will seek some balance within the available resources. And the areas in which trade-offs are likely to be made will be eligibles, who's covered, and the choices made there will have impacts on uninsurance rates in the state, on the health status of low-income Oregonians in the state, and on cost shift within the healthcare market. The next area where trade-offs would likely be made is in benefits, in terms of what is covered, and that also will impact the health status of low-income Oregonians and will impact cost shift. And the last area is reimbursement trade-offs, and choices made there will impact access, the viability of community solutions in terms of community infrastructures that support delivery of health care to low-income Oregonians, the quality of care that's available, and once again, cost shift will be a factor. And with that concludes our Medicaid 101. If I were a true instructor, I'd go back to page 2 with the objectives of the presentation to see whether or not we met them, but I'll leave it at here.
Sure. Representative Smith.
If you were a true instructor, we'd get college credit. I want my college credit.
Yeah. Lynn, I want to thank you because this really was truly a very, very good presentation, and you were a very good instructor. I've asked the other agencies to also do 101. I think that it's made it easier for this body to understand some of the intricacies of the program that's within inside of the Office of Medical Assistance. How about that? I didn't.
Thank you.
And you know, you imparted a lot of knowledge in a very short period of time, and I want to thank you for the work that you've done, and would encourage those who are remaining to come before us to make it as straightforward, as simplistic as possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I would also like to note that it's been a very helpful presentation for me, and I would also observe that it's been very helpful for our staffs, many of whom are tuned in while these hearings are taking place. And I know in the case of our office, where we have two people brand new to the session this time, this has been very instructive. So I thank you for the approach.
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
I turn to you, John, in terms of whether or not you're ready to have Vicki Green or...
Yeah, we can go ahead and do Darren.
Okay.
The Health Services Commission, and then we'll come back to eligibility. Welcome, Darren.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darren Kaufman. I'm director of the Health Services Commission, and I'll try and follow Lynn's read in giving you a little bit of a 101 on Health Services Commission, and then give you some detail on what we've been up to for the past 2 years. And in looking at Lynn's handout, I don't think I could have put together a better summary than she did. So to start things off, I'm actually going to refer you back to pages 37 and 38 of the document that she provided, and just flesh some of those areas out a little bit for you. The Health Services Commission was established in 1989 by Senate Bill 27. And there's a 11-member Health Services Commission, all-voluntary body that's governor-appointed and approved by the Senate. They serve 4-year renewable terms. There are 5 physician members, 4 healthcare consumers, 1 social worker, and 1 public health nurse, and that is all spelled out in statute as in terms of the composition. The charge to the Health Services Commission is to prioritize health services in order of importance to the population to be served. And I can recall some of the early meetings of the Health Services Commission in terms of, well, this is a task that's never been done before anywhere in the world, and this is all we're being given as a guideline. So there was much struggling early on, and it took about a year and a half before the first prioritized list was developed and subsequently submitted to the Healthcare Finance Administration for approval. The early iterations of the prioritized list were much more objectively based in terms of numbers. Health outcomes measurements were incorporated into the prioritization process, along with public values that were gathered through public hearings and community meetings. However, the list or the methodology that was developed as a result of that, and the list that was produced, was ultimately denied by the federal government for implementation in August of 1992, and the commission felt that the goal of expanding access to health care for Oregonians' poor populations was more important than arguing over what methodology would be used to achieve those means. And so the commission got back together and actually revised the methodology not once but 2 more times before approval was granted. And the methodology that we've now been working under since April of 1993 is much more subjective in nature. The federal government said that we could use prevention of death as a measurement in ranking services. They agreed that death was a bad thing, and to prevent that was good. They said that we could use cost of service, that a lower cost for the same effectiveness of treatments was better than a higher cost service. And then that was it. That was all we were able to use for objective measurements. And as a matter of fact, I can recall one night at midnight printing out the list before the next day's commission meeting. And we actually had to, in order to break ties, because there were many things that were tied based on those two measurements, we had to use the alphabet as a means to break the ties. But what it basically boiled down to was that commissioner judgment played a key role in the final prioritization process. They had to look back on all the testimony that they had received from the public and come up with a methodology that could incorporate those values into the prioritized list, and I think they did a pretty good job of that. Once the prioritized list is developed, we send it on to an independent actuary for pricing determination using the thousands of medical codes that appear on the list. They determine price levels for different points in the prioritized list, about every 30 lines or so. And then basically that list is given to you folks to determine where on the list we can fund down to in terms of the resources that are available. And I think that's a key point that we certainly like to make to people looking at our process, is the fact that the Health Services Commission is involved in the prioritization of the list, but not in recommending any particular level of funding down that list. Let me go into a little bit about the prioritized list of health services and the way that it looks. Generally speaking, those services that are ranked higher are things that involve life-saving treatments. The example given here is appendectomy for appendicitis. I can recall in a very early iteration of, and we don't even like to refer to it as a version of the list, but the data dump that we had about 9 months into the process, we actually had thumb-sucking ranked above appendectomy. And believe me, the media had a field day with that one. But and obviously we had to modify the methodology after that point. But the key is that you know, looking strictly at numbers, sometimes the value of life isn't evident enough with straight numbers, and that's why those things that involve life-saving treatments that had really any measurable effectiveness to any degree needed to be given a little bit preferential treatment in the process.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordon.
And pardon my interruption. Mr. Britton, help. Do we have the prioritized list in our notebooks or somewhere?
Won't be out.
Is it out?
You don't, and I was about to get to that, but what basically happened is I was all ready to send the report to the printer kind of early March, and then we had the change in benefit packages to OHP standard, and we're required actually to include in our report the information on the pricing of the OHP standard benefit package, and so I had to hold off on sending it to the printer until I received that information. The latest I've been told is that I should receive something by the end of this week. And so the list would, or the report would go to the printer next week and be available later this month. What I have done is I've printed out a draft copy basically 90% of the material as we have it without that actuarial piece. And I'll leave that with your staff for you to refer to.
Thank you.
And you're talking about the benefit package under 2519?
Yeah, that's the piece that was changed that we now need to wait for pricing on. Other things that are ranked high on the prioritized list, maternity care services. We were clearly told by the public that resources need to be spent on prenatal visits and delivery services for low-income Oregonians, and so those services appear high on the prioritized list, as do preventive services, well-child visits, screenings for high cholesterol, things of that nature with some level of proven effectiveness also appear high. Examples of things that appear low on the prioritized list, self-limited conditions such as viral illnesses, which will basically run their course whether you provide treatment or not beyond the diagnosis. And that brings up a key point, is that you don't go to the prioritized list and determine whether a service is covered or not until you've reached the stage of achieving a diagnosis. So the client comes into the physician's office complaining of a sore throat. You don't know if that's a strep throat or a viral sore throat, and the diagnostic service, that first diagnostic visit, is paid for to determine that distinction. If it's a strep throat, then further treatment is going to be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. If it's a viral sore throat, then additional visits or prescription drugs would not be covered. Cosmetic services also prioritized low on the list. The example of benign skin lesions that have basically no effect on a person's health status. And generally speaking, those services that were determined to be ineffective in their nature, advanced cancers that have spread to distant parts of the body, are an example of those types of services. The 2001-2003 prioritized list is 736 line items long. Right now we're currently covering through 558 on that list. The new list, which will be included in the report, is going to be 730 line items long, and the equivalent coverage on that list is going to be line 549. Basically what happens is the Health Services Commission is required to do a thorough review of the prioritized list every 2 years. And in doing that, there's line items that get moved around on the list. There's merging of two or more line items together into a single line item, and there's splitting of line items from one line item into multiple ones. Lately, the commission has been more in a mood to merge lines than split lines, and so it's resulted into an ever-shrinking list, if you will. I think we started out with about 745 line items, and we're down to 730 on the new list. And so if you draw the line at 549 on the new list, that's going to represent basically the same benefit package that is provided as we speak.
If a lot of what's occurring is merging the lines and not eliminating, then is there really any cost savings in that particular practice?
Well, the merging of the lines is really kind of an academic process. The commission has found, you know, two line items that are either next to each other on the list or right near each other on the list, which involve conditions of the same body system that have the same general effectiveness of treatment and the same cost of treatment. And so it's a little bit of an academic exercise in defining what constitutes a line item and what when you should actually split a line item up into multiple ranges. I remember the first time that we even tried to put together a list, we had 1,600 line items on the list, and the commission took a look at that and said, it's just too many. It's just hard to manage that many line items, and so since that time, they've just been merging them together as a rule.
And my question is if it has any budgetary implications.
No, I mean that the actuaries are still pricing it out every 30 lines. You know, if you've got two line items that were previously next to each other merged into one, I guess that does, if it comes at one of those break-off points, would result in the inability to price out the exact per capita cost in between those two sets of services. But again, it's kind of the commission's belief that if they're, you know, extremely similar services, then to cover one and not the other would be kind of, you know, six to one, half dozen to the other.
The answer is basically.
So the answer is virtually no financial difference. If there's no questions on the kind of the background of the Health Services Commission, I'll go into some of the things that the commission has done in the last 2 years.
Senator Gordley.
I do have a question, and perhaps you will address this in your upcoming remarks. I would like to know how the commission has addressed the issue of racial and ethnic disparities in health care over the course of its work.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. Generally speaking, the commission, I think, is trying to make it a point not to look at any particular subpopulations as to whether they would be, you know, negatively impacted or positively impacted by a particular placement of a service. You know, just in the way that they don't take age into account in terms of if you've got a person with diabetes that's 60 versus 30, there's no distinction on the list that would rank one of those higher than the other. And I think the same can be said for racial and ethnicity factors. I mean, that's not to say that we haven't taken a look at certain services that might impact a particular subpopulation more than others. But generally speaking, you know, we're still trying to use the same methodology in looking at the effectiveness of treatment, the cost of treatment, and the public values, and making the ultimate determination as to where a service will finally land on the list.
Follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair. I was hoping for a different kind of response. What I'm hearing is somewhat troubling. Let me clarify. How has the Commission discussed the topic of racial and ethnic disparities in health care? Has that been a focus of discussion on the commission during the time that you've been director?
To be quite honest, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I can't say it has been a focus of discussion. I think the commission would like to think that they are prioritizing services to the best of their ability to, equally represent the importance to all populations. I can certainly, say that particular discussion has come up around certain services that might be utilized more by certain ethnic populations than others. One that might come to mind is sickle cell anemia.
Let me follow up. Are there currently any people of color on the commission?
Currently, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have one Native American on the commission, and that is the only only person that I can name. We have had other people of color in the past, but not none other at this point in time. We currently have a vacancy, and we certainly do try to take that into account when we look at applicants, but it's ultimately the governor's appointment.
Follow-up, Chair. Are you familiar with the governor's task force on racial and ethnic health?
Yes, I am.
Have you read the report issued by that task force?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I've read the executive summary, but not the entire report.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Just kind of along that line, the diseases that are predominantly in women, have those diseases been discussed? There are certain things that are unique to certain, even gender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly, all services basically have to be ranked by the Health Services Commission, and certainly it's known when there are services that are used almost exclusively by one gender versus another. And again, that's I would say that I don't think that there's any service on the list that's necessarily been placed higher than another just because of it being used by one gender or another. That's not to say that it hasn't been acknowledged. We do have, at all times, we've had a OBGYN, obstetrician gynecologist, on the Health Services Commission, and have looked to them to give us input in terms of services.
Beyond the reproductive basis. But things like some of the autoimmune disorders tend to be more prevalent in women than they are in men, for example. Lupus, for example, is more prevalent in the female population than it is in men. So I'm looking, and if you're having those kinds of discussions where you have a preponderance of a disease that's occurring more in one segment of the population than the other segment. Does that get discussed? I think that's what the senator is asking.
Mm-hmm. We wouldn't make a distinction of the treatment of lupus in women versus men. I think for the most part, a driving factor comes down to the effectiveness of treatment. I mean, we've got services that are prioritized low that you can look at, and some of those services are used primarily by women, and some are used primarily by men. There certainly wasn't any intention to place one gender services lower than another. It's just basically a medical fact if something can be treated or not, and I think that was the driving force behind most of the placement on the list.
Was the driving factor long-term treatment versus short-term treatment? I guess I'm trying to grapple with what the parameters are in the decision making.
Certainly, long-term outcomes are weighted more heavily than short-term outcomes. Again, such things as self-limited conditions where you're really talking about maybe reducing symptoms over a short period of time is certainly not going to be given the weight of something that can make a factor in the person's health status for a long time.
It would not be high up on the spectrum, up on, in that. chronic diseases, which would be like your arthritis and those kinds of things that are a longer term than something that's a tonsil being removed, for example. Is that kind of the thing that you look at in the commission?
I guess I would say that chronic diseases would have a much greater chance of having a different long-term outcome if you didn't provide treatment. In the case of chronic illness, it's not necessarily a case of, you know, certainly curing a person or even necessarily making them better. It might be simply the ability to maintain that person at their highest level of health status possible.
Okay. Senator Carter.
I'd just like to ask two questions. Because really, this question has never come up before, even when I was on the front part of us talking about health care commission. But what is the mission of the commission?
The mission is to prioritize health services according to their importance to the population to be served. And the commission uses clinical medical information, and maybe even to more degree, public input, public values in coming up with that order of importance. That's their sole function.
Okay. Second follow up. So then, the latest issue of MS, multiple sclerosis, in the Northwest, that reaching epidemic proportion, would that be an issue for the commission? Or is just looking at the related diseases so that we can prioritize a list to deal with cost containment? What would you say?
Well, we would hope that, you know, cost containment wouldn't be the sole purpose for having the existence of the list. I mean, generally speaking, you know, we would like to see the list used to make sure that the limited resources that the state has goes to treating the most effective and the most important medical conditions that are out there. In the case of MS, I think that that would be something that the commission would take into account. If you've got an outbreak of a condition, one of the kind of subjective values that they used was public health risk for moving something up or down. In this case, up. I think the commission would be interested in that sort of information.
Question?
Reverend Smith, G. Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Previous questions direct me to ask my question. Your Health Service Commission members, where do they get, how do they get their input from rural Oregon? I notice none of the members represent rural Oregon.
We have a commission member from Klamath Falls, and unfortunately, we just lost our commission member from Redmond, Oregon, and so we have a vacant spot there. And we certainly take into account geographic distribution when we look at filling a vacancy.
Chair Winters, it's very important for me as I'm looking at the prioritized list that will be coming. To ensure that I have confidence in what's being presented. And when I hear that Klamath Falls is rural, that's troubling to me.
Mm-hmm.
To me, rural is John Day,
mm-hmm.
maybe Wallowa, mm-hmm. maybe Union,
mm-hmm.
Communities that are 50, 100 miles from healthcare, communities that have a physician's assistant that comes once a month to the community to provide health care, communities that don't have a pharmacy. That's my interpretation of rural. And so I guess between now and the time we go through everything, I would hope you folks could share with me how rural concerns mm-hmm. have been addressed.
Mm-hmm. And well,
keep in mind that I don't view Ashland or Klamath Falls as mm-hmm. rural.
Again, we would certainly provide the governor with input to that effect as he looks at making an appointment for our next vacancy. One of the things that the commission, I think, takes very seriously is the collection of public values. And there have been four times since the commission's existence that we have actually conducted community meetings around the state in an attempt to collect those values. I do know that when the list was initially prioritized that there were almost 50 community meetings held, at least one in every county of the state. And certainly as we've gone back to receive additional public input, we certainly hit all regions of the state. We certainly can't go to every or a number of rural communities, but we try to find some place that's kind of centrally located, whether that might be LeGrand or Burns.
What's the smallest community you visit?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I was not involved with the initial project that held the 50 community meetings, so I could not tell you which one was the smallest.
Thank you.
Representative T. Smith.
Regarding Representative Greg Smith's questions, I don't mean to speak for you, but maybe your questions can be interpreted as, in the rural areas of Oregon, we don't have access to certain services. And I think maybe in rural Oregon, it's not that our health needs are that different from anybody else's. This is just the access question mm-hmm. and getting served. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't think there's a meeting that's gone by that the commission hasn't brought up the issue of access, particularly when they were working on the prioritization of the benefit packages for OHP standard and which services it was more important to have access to, with a focus certainly on primary type services. And I know that there have been many times where the commission has put together lists of kind of principles to recognize as different prioritized lists have been available, and access is at the top of nearly each of those lists. But in terms of the charge to the Health Services Commission, like you said, the needs of rural Oregonians isn't necessarily all that different than those in the Willamette Valley. And so when you look at the prioritized list, you know, I don't think it's easy to say, well, you know, this service is ranked at this point because rural Oregonians necessarily need it more than others. The commission tries to look at the good for all Oregonians in making its ultimate decisions.
That's a good question. Thank you, Chair. How do you determine that when you haven't walked a mile in those folks' shoes? How do you determine, as you're looking at the big picture, the health care prioritized list, how can you tell for Spray, Oregon, what's the greatest need?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you know, I guess I would just have to defer to my commissioners and their collective wisdom in collecting information, their years of experience in the healthcare community in being able to make some of those judgments.
Just one last, yeah. I promise to let it go.
Okay, because I need to move on.
I promise. I guess what I would point out is I have zero ability to tell the folks in Portland what their health care needs are. and I wouldn't even pretend to tell them that. At the same time, I think it'd be very difficult for a physician at St. Vincent's Hospital to tell Lakeview what their health care needs are. I see you have a vacant position under the physician section. I would sure hope you would encourage someone from rural Oregon, whatever part of Oregon, mm-hmm. but so long as it's rural, to be on the phone. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, you're welcome. Just a point of observation, and I think it is extremely difficult and a task that the Commission have when you're looking at the array of diseases and what have you to come up with a prioritized list. I think one of the things that the altruistic piece of that they've tried to do, and that's the public values. Because when you get into values, that kind of discussion, what would be a value in Northeast Portland, for example, or a value in rural Oregon may not be the same statewide, and I think that's what Representative Smith is trying to say. And I think it's that piece when you say that the commission has put a high priority on, quote, public value, and it's like, whose value?
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Can I just indulge you for a minute? Because I'm trying to keep quiet. We don't even want to talk about public value. When I went before the commission, one of the arrogant doctors there said I came by like a drive-by shooter. So they were totally insensitive at that particular moment. You were not there, so you don't have to bear this burden of my negative comments about the commission's actions when it comes down to values. Because when you look at certain medications, there are certain medications that African Americans cannot take because it does not fit within the realm of medications that they can take. That is a public value. That is of interest to the people that I represent and that I serve in this state. And that is a very important one. I'm just hoping that since you're there as a director, and with Ms. Lowe being here now, a person that I trust implicitly in terms of her work in the state, I'm hoping that the commission will be much more open to the whole public value issue from this day forward than what they were in the past. And I'm trying to keep my comments so they won't sound so negative to you, but they have every reason to sound negative because public value has not been anything I saw them embrace with a degree of comfort.
And Senator, there's another commission that we haven't heard from that also plays in this, and that's the Health Resources Commission. And I don't want to confuse the two because some of this may be coming out of that, but I think that you do hear the message that value issue is an issue if you're talking about difference in localities in the state, and there's a difference if you're talking about a ethnic group, and there's a difference if you're talking about women, and that's why I said that, because, you know, interesting enough, you know, I recall that it's taken a long time for some of the women's issues that have to do with medical treatment, even in research, to raise to a level of where you do get enough interest in the medical community to go ahead and do those studies. So I don't want to belabor this anymore. Let's move on because I do have to wrap. I do have to leave, and so I think we'll move on. And I know that my members, I'll ask them to talk to you afterward. They have a lot of questions on this issue. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just say one thing, and just as Senator Carter, I think looks highly at Ellen Lowe and her ability to speak for the public. I think the same goes for all of the members of the Health Services Commission, and she's certainly our leader in knowing the pulse of the public and all Oregonians, and we certainly defer to her in many of the decisions that we make.
I would encourage that when you talk to the governor to look at two things as he makes the appointments as they become vacant. One, the rural issue, and other, the ethnic issue, so that you're getting a broad perspective inside of your discussion and your debate, and that truly reflects Oregon. I think that.
Madam Chair, I'll be sure to pass that on. Just kind of quickly following up, I'm not going to go into any detail on the work that the commission did on the prioritized list of benefit packages for OHP standard. We submitted a report in January or July of 2002 on that work. That's actually included as an appendix to our larger biennial report. I think the focus of what you're looking to hear on is the larger prioritized list that basically serves as the basis for the benefit packages that are defined by all Oregon Health Plan recipients. Just to give you a little bit of information on some of the changes that were made to the prioritized list during the last biennial review, I think there was probably more movement of line items on the list probably than we've seen since its initial creation in 1993. And I think that the Commission feels strongly, and I've certainly heard other stakeholder groups agree, that the list as it will stand for 0305 gives the legislature, I think, more flexibility in the chance to move the funding level up should that be determined to be necessary, that those services that are prioritized just above the current funding line would have a higher likelihood of being approved for elimination by the federal government than I think the list that was in effect for 2001 and 2003. For example, there were some treatments for cancers that were down near the funding line, and the Commission looked at some of the more recent health outcomes information that's come about in the last few years, and those services have been moved to a higher placement on the list because their effectiveness has been improved. In addition to the biennial review that the Commission does every 2 years, the Commission needs to make interim modifications to the prioritized list to keep up with the literally hundreds of changes that occur to the medical coding systems that make up the framework of the prioritized list. And those are done once every 6 months. And we will also be in the near future looking at changes to the list that need to be made because of the Health Insurance Privacy and Accountability Act, whereby...
He didn't use an acronym.
I've heard about these things. You know, the pigs here are very intimidating. and also... To take it to another level, the International Classification of Diseases 10th Edition Clinical Modification is also on the horizon, which basically is taking a diagnostic coding system from about 17,000 codes to about 45,000 codes that we're going to have to be dealing with in the near future. You know, some of these levels of detail are talking about if you're fracturing the little toe on the left foot. So it's getting down to quite a high level of detail. And we've got to kind of roll along with those punches. Finally, I kind of wanted to end by letting you know some of the newest work that we've begun to undertake. And I mean, I think it's become quite apparent that there is only so much that can be done with the prioritized list kind of in a vertical sense in terms of moving the funding line up. We've certainly seen times when it's been difficult to get approval from the federal government to make the types of changes in the funding level that we might like to, although it seems to have eased up a little bit. The Commission's focus now is on what is eloquently being referred to as squeezing the list from the sides, looking at the breadth of services that are included in the different line items within a list. And really, when the list was first created, we had to basically identify what services would be put on these line items by having provider groups come to us, you know, day after day and endless hours of testimony as to the services they provided that they felt were effective for their clients. Certainly since that time, there's been much more evidence-based literature that's become available, and we're going to start to go through that in a very rigorous manner and making sure that all of the services that are included in the funded region or prioritized list are in fact effective, and that we don't need to be looking at making some of these distinctions and eliminating some of those services that are currently included on some of those lines or moving them down on the list. And that's not to say that in other cases we might find that some services that are relatively lower placed have now been shown to be more effective and they may need to be moved up. And so with that, I think in summary, the Health Services Commission certainly thanks the legislature for their ability to serve the Oregonians in prioritizing services and making the Oregon Health Plan hopefully sustainable and provided to the highest extent possible. And we would certainly stand it ready if you decide that you should need our services in any other manner.
Thank you very much. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have time for a big question, a big picture question?
A big picture question, but we're going to be out of here by a quarter of, and we have a walkthrough on eligibility determination.
Well, I've just raised the question. If we look at the rising costs of providing medical care today, they're running nationally in the 14% to 15%, and there's no indication that that's going to change. So if you look at that on a biennial basis, we're looking at another $1 billion just to maintain that list. That's a 30% increase. Where is the sustainability of the Oregon Health Plan with the rising costs of providing medical care?
Madam?
I think that would be a more appropriate question to ask Barry or Lynn.
We can defer that, the discussion on that, yeah. It's fine, but I just, you know, where are we going with this program,
yeah,
is the question.
I think that's a question for the director of OMAP and for the agency and for Lynn. They're one piece of a service modality, and I don't think it's fair to ask Darren that kind of question. But I do think we can have a dialogue with the agency.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think the Commission hopes that their newer work in terms of looking at services prioritized within these line items and potentially, again, trying to use the resources in the best possible areas and where they're most effective is will hopefully be a part that the Health Services Commission can play in that role, but there are, you know, much larger issues at play.
Yeah, that's one tool. It's interesting because even Darren's, the Health Services Commission does, still has to be approved by the federal government. I think sometimes we forget about all the pieces that have to play and the implications of the line. We've talked a lot about in this building about above and below the line and whether or not the federal counterpart will approve those lines once the commission has completed its work, which has actually an implication on the budget, as we talk about the budget drivers, and that's one piece of many that occurs. So,
Madam Chair, I just need to be a whole lot more comfortable than I am right now that there's someone on the Health Services Commission who has a deep understanding of health care outcomes for people of color. I didn't hear that. And so come and visit me and help me understand what that really looks like, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon-Lee, I certainly will.
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to call up Barry.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
I just thought, in case you didn't want to let Darren escape without being taxed for an acronym, He did refer to the bank sitting in front of him as a PIG, which in some circles refers, it's an acronym, it refers to private insurance programs, you see. And I think we got him there.
Darren, would you make your contribution to Rosie? and with that, would Barry and McNaughton and Vicki please come forward?
I'd be glad to, whether I said an acronym.
By the way, I think we should audit those PIGs later. They seem to be getting mighty full of money.
You had asked for more information on eligibility and how eligibility worked, and so we've invited Vicki Green to come to help us understand eligibility determination, how the system works, how it interfaces with the work in OMAP.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make one comment before I introduce Vicki Green.
And you can comment on the cost.
Madam Chair, I was grateful that I was not at the table at the moment that question was asked. The question of medical inflation and the rising costs, as Senator Morse pointed out, approaching 15% of our economy and rising at about that rate every year raises real questions about policy that need to be addressed and are very complicated. And that's one of the reasons why we do have the functions involved in financing and managing health care for certain Oregonians divided among different parts of the organization. And I think there's been some confusion about that. Health Services is responsible for the management of the benefits that are received by people who are eligible for the Medicaid program and certain other programs. We do not manage the determination of eligibility. That is vested in Community Human Services, and Ramona Foley presented that budget to you. In addition, we do not do the caseload work within Health Services ourselves. That's done in the Finance and Policy Analysis section, and Margie Johnson directs that section and reports directly to Gene Thorne. And finally, outside the department, because I think the legislature, in its wisdom, thought that policy ought to have an independent and objective review, is the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. And Dr. Goldberg is the current director of that office. And they provide staffing to the commissions. So you can see that it's the interrelationship of these functions is an important part of the architecture of this. And not all of these functions are vested in one place. And that diversity of policy, management, budgeting is intentional and is designed to put a more better foundation under the program. Now, having said all of that, I want to introduce Vicki Green, who's the administrator of the Oregon Health Plan Processing Center, and they do the work that you've been inquiring about with respect to determining eligibility for the plan. I hope that was helpful in clarifying the functions.
Welcome.
Thank you. This morning when I got a call for to come and talk with you, I thought, what would they like to know? So I like handouts, so I copied some things for you that might be helpful.
And Vicki, would you state your name for the record?
My name is Vicki Green, and I work for Community Human Services and, like you said, the Statewide Processing Center.
You may go ahead.
All right. What he's passing out to you is a flow chart of how the application process works, because my understanding of today or this afternoon's is that you wanted to know more detail about how that works. So what I've given you is a flow chart and then the application itself, a blank one. So we'll start with the flow chart. And the flow chart starts with first a client calling the application center, which is a 1-800 number, which OMAP, Oregon Medical Assistance Program, has contracted to get the applications. And the clients are asked a few questions like their name, address, so on and so forth, and basic questions, and mailed out an application. They can also get applications at any of our Department of Human Services field offices. throughout the state. When we received the application in our office here in Salem at the processing center, they are barcoded at the contractors so that we can keep track of them. And the reason that is we get 20-some thousand applications a month, and if a client sends in more than one, we can't match them up together. So by having the barcode on that, we can do that. We can tell you each step that that application goes through, and that's in a computer base. The applications are then sorted for a variety of different sorts, whether or not they're new, brand new applications, or they're being recertified after 6 months. Because remember, client has to be recertified and looked at again every 6 months. They have to reapply. We do some sorts to figure out what language, because we have about 9 different languages and diversity ethnic groups. We determine whether or not the application is somebody in the household's pregnant, because we're going to do that quicker, put that in a priority. Whether or not the household has domestic violence, whether or not there should be looked at for other programs to make sure that they get into the right category. We have 21 medical programs, and a household could have 5 or 10 people in it, and all of them could be eligible for a different program. So it's quite an undertaking to try to determine what program they might be eligible for. We also have integrated services to senior services and disability, so we have those type of workers in our statewide processing center, so that we don't have to send them out to the field specialized offices, so that we can do the work right there. We then go through the application packet that I gave you a copy of, which you see it's 10, 12 pages. And they go through each question on there. And then they go through, the workers then go through the screen checks, meaning on the computer they can go through wage match to see if the client's showing up on the wage match screen. We can go through child support screen and Social Security screens to see if there's income that are on the system that the client has or has not told us about. Remembering that the wage match screen is 3 or 4 months behind. So that's the problem, because we're looking at their actual income, and the wage match screen that we look at from employers reporting from the employment department is 3 or 4 months behind. Those are the 3 screens that are mandatory that the employees have to check on each of the adult or children that are working in the households. And if we do not have all the information that we need in the application that was asked for, then we'll pin the application. We have about a 32% pin rate, and that's because they don't send us what they need to send us.
What's the pin rate?
Pin rate, pending, meaning the application is pinned.
P-E-N-D.
P-E-N-D. Okay. Pinned rate.
Okay.
The application is pended. It's held in a bucket until we get all the information we need.
I was just asking because I was just going to tell you need to pay Rosie.
I'll pay Rosie. It is a word, though.
You're right. That is a word.
And it's not an acronym, but I'll pay Rosie. Once we get all the information from the client, then the worker then can determine the eligibility of the case and put the case on the system, which means we'll approve and a medical card will go out and so on and so forth. If they don't get the information that they need, the case is denied. It's not processed. We send them a notice. We send them, it's on the system. We are working through technology right now where you can actually image the application. So we're going to paperless. We're piloting that right now. Image the application so it'll come up on a screen, and we won't have to pass these 23,000 applications around the office. So we're piloting that right now. But it's technology, and it's, you know, something new.
Question?
Reverend Smith.
I noticed this application, to me, is pretty thorough. It's more thorough than I imagined it to be, which I think is good. How long does it take the average person to fill this out, and do they understand all the questions out?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I have actually filled it out, helped people fill it out who've come.
Well, I'm wondering about that. How much assistance are they given? Because I don't think.
I think the average person, if they filled out any kind of government papers, would have, you know, the normal amount of problems filling it out. But even myself, where I work there, I had some questions about, well, what's that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few questions that even working there.
Follow up.
I might not know how to answer, but.
Would this be an application that they would have to take home to get the rest of the information and then bring back later?
Our process is all a mail-in process. We do not see clients. It's all done through the mail.
I see.
So they would be calling many of our 1-800 numbers to get help filling it out for the outreach facilities.
Well, it sounds like you're not making it too easy as far as filling out the paperwork, you know. With that in mind, we still have a huge amount of people on the Oregon Health Plan.
I noted that the form was revised in 01, October of 01. And I guess when I looked at this, I had the same kind of reaction that Representative Smith had. But also another reaction, and you may, whenever you go through, do forms management again, look at whether or not your form flows to relevancy. And I don't know how your computer's set up, but, you know, I immediately spotted some duplications. On the one hand, if you're a non-U.S. citizen, which implies that you're not a U.S. citizen, there's information there. And then if I look at the crosstabs across on name, relationship, Social Security, date of birth, OHP for this person, mm-hmm. citizens, non-citizens,
mm-hmm.
U.S., and it's...
Mm-hmm.
I'm going and saying I would be discouraged, and I don't know why we have so many on the health plan, because if I look at five, six...
That was my reaction, Jackie.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, this application is also done, like I said, in our field offices where they would have face-to-face contact. For outstation workers at the hospital, like outreach workers, at all the hospitals or most of them have people that help them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields, I think we're enlightened that there was so much that was asked.
I would like to point out the corollary to this. I mean, you're amazed at how complicated it is and yet how many people filled it out. I would point out that goes to show how desperate people are and how they really do need this.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying 10 pages says something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Once the case is approved or denied online, then they are carried in just a caseload. And we have a phone bank of folks who answer the phone all day long, of 12 people who answer all these questions just in our office. And so if they call in about a premium, an address change, whatever the situation is, we have a staff of people who can answer those questions or help them.
What are the basis on most denials?
Most denials is their income. They don't verify their income or tell us their income. So it's mostly income related.
Senator Carter,
this is just mind-blowing. 12 people. Do nothing but this. That's a lot. That's a lot.
12 people answer the phone. That's our phone bank staff through the 1-800 number that answer the phone.
If the
hours a day.
If it's because of incomplete information on the income page, or that's the reason for the denial, or is it not sufficient information that's on the page? I mean, I'm.
Madam Chair, the question is that I.
You said most denials are due because of too much income.
No, due to income. Either they're not verifying it
verified
for us,
income.
Or they're not sending us the information, or it has to do with their over income. But most of them are because they haven't told us, or they don't get us the information.
Question?
Smith.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I'm very impressed with this application. to me it seems, and I guess correct me if I'm wrong here, is part of this completed on the honor system? What happens if a citizen from rural Oregon completed this application and mailed it to Salem? How would you be able to verify income as a ranching job?
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Smith, it is on the honor-based system in terms of the client fills it out, or an advocate or somebody helps them fill it out. They sign it. They submit it. But we have a variety of screens that if the person has been here in Oregon that we can check. We can check to see if they've ever worked in the state of Oregon. We can check if they've ever received child support or been through the child support system or Social Security system or DMV or, I mean, we've got a variety of things that we can check. If for some reason some doesn't make sense, then we would go back and ask them more questions. For instance, if we show that they've worked all their life here in Oregon and all of a sudden they haven't, on the wage match screen, or we'll ask them, you know, the application asks them to send in verification. We want to know how they've been living, how they've been paying their rent or their utilities or their house payment. We need to know, we need to have enough pieces to the puzzle to put the puzzle together that makes enough sense to us.
Senator Purvis,
thank you. Chair Carter. I don't even know which question to ask first. This is going to sound really bad, but I'm going to ask anyway. I could see where you could hide income. I mean, let me give you an example. Individual could go for, could have a limited liability company with the assets all in that limited liability company, and when they put down their income, it would be very nominal. They would own no assets. And I guess the reason I raised this committee is I actually know a situation in which a very well-off individual was proudly boasting of being on the health plan and shouldn't have been. And granted, there's numerous folks, and you can't screen everyone, but I guess my observation is this really is almost an honor system program.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, when it first started in the early 90s, it was self-declared. We didn't check any screens. We just basically took what they said. Since then, we've put a lot of stopgap measures into place. We have a self-employment team, and I don't know if the person that you were talking about previously is considered self-employed, but we work with tax folks. We work with, we put together a trained team of people who do all the self-employment applications. We've straighten that up so that we can get to just exactly what it is you're describing.
Well, I do applaud you. I think this is a good application.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
There's always a dilemma in public programs between the honor system and verification. And it costs to verify. And I think over the years, what I'm hearing and what I understand, although this is another part of the department, is that we've become better and better at verification, but it's no one can guarantee that there aren't people who are receiving benefits who probably shouldn't be getting them. But the cost of making sure that no one gets a benefit they don't deserve may far exceed the savings to the state from doing that. So we're always in that dilemma. And the other dilemma is that we have two missions here. One is cost containment, and the other is customer service, the public sector equivalent of customer service. And to the extent that we're dealing with people who have been, for the most part, disenfranchised in some way or another, we don't want to impart to them a sense that they are in some ways a different class of people. Sure. On the other hand, we also want to make sure we are responsible to the public and control costs and control fraud. And I think that's also true when I file my income taxes next week. I'm putting my signature on the line, and I could be hiding income, and in some countries, most people do. So it requires a balance there, and we try to achieve that in the department.
George, you look like you wanted to have something to say a few minutes ago. Did you want to chime
in? Well, Madam Chair, what I was going to mention is that, as Vicki mentioned, this, as I've looked at the Oregon Health Plan over time, we went through a period initially when we first ramped up the Oregon Health Plan, we were trying to get people into the system, and then we spent about 4 to 6 years where we added more and more things onto these verification applications, and you saw the caseload go like that. So it is exactly the balance that Barry's talking about. You give up some by adding more and more items and more checks. Some of the people, as Senator Shields mentioned, who may be eligible for the program may choose not to participate simply because it's such a headache to get in the door. And so that's constantly the balance. And as we simplify these systems, you do see more and more people flowing into them. Food stamps is a great example of that. We simplified the food stamp application process, and we saw a lot more people flowing into the system. That is a value judgment that this body makes, and then this agency tries to implement on your behalf.
I think one more, Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Smith, I think one more thing to just is that we have an investigative overpayment referral process. So if a worker gets a hit, so to speak, something doesn't check out, you know, something on the screen tells us one thing, but their application tells us another, we can do a referral to that unit who will then check it out for us. They have even more screens than we do. But we're only requiring them to check three screens because of the amount of applications we have coming through. That's all they can really do.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Other questions about the application process?
Manager?
Thank you, Dot.
Thanks. Sorry, I was gone. We're down working on these very issues in another part of the building right now, so I'm running back and forth. And it was interesting that we just finished discussing eligibility and how we're determining eligibility in this other meeting, and I'd like to ask a few questions because we didn't know the answers. Maybe there aren't any answers. So, with your permission,
please do.
How many people do you have actually in the state actually trying to determine eligibility, roughly?
In Oregon Health Plan only, I'd say there's probably about 200 people. Doing eligibility is probably close to 100.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please do.
And these people are not an OMAP, they're an AFS, right?
They're Department of Human Services under Community Human Services.
And, Madam Chair, can I just
flow with it.
My understanding is that these people have a kind of a high turnover in that job, and it's a low income. They're not paid the top wage, so to speak, and yet we're loading this burden on them of trying to determine a very difficult eligibility requirement for the fairly complex form. Is that my information correct on that?
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, the turnover rate is about 11% for Oregon Health Plan. On a statewide basis under Department of Human Services, the average is about 10%. The reason is that it is a production. They do not talk to clients per se except for maybe on the telephone. And frankly, it's a good training ground for them to go other places because it is an entry-level job. And so they go to the field offices where they get paid more. It's a higher classification. Many of our people leave, though, and they come back. They don't like other jobs that they get. So they like we have standards in place. They know what has to be done. They know how much they have to process a month to meet the standards. So a lot of people like that kind of work. And we have all different kind of shifts. We have night shifts, day shifts, so they can work most any time.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we were grappling with the same problems you're grappling with, making the system work for those people who really need it, but keeping out people who are actually abusing the system. We have had numerous reports of people moving into the state on sort of an anecdotal basis, come in, get health care, and leave, and the difficulty of tracking those people and determining whether they really were residents of Oregon for a length of time. There's some federal issues involved in that also, obviously. And what I'm trying to find here is, from your point of view, since your people are kind of where the rubber hits the road, you know, what do they need to be more effective? What would help them? We want to tighten this up. Even if it's just a perception problem, politically, it's a very serious problem if the wrong people are in the plan. And it's, you know, as the people who have to look after the plan, who have to make it viable, who have to keep it viable, this is something that's very difficult for us to deal with. There's people who are in the plan that shouldn't be there, something we constantly hear about.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. I've been in this work 33 years, since I was 19, so... And it is just exactly what they say, is that, you know, the workers would love to have more time to determine the eligibility, but frankly, we have the number of applications coming in that we're trying to get within 10 to 14 days of processing, and we're on the average now about 30 days out. Mm-hmm. So that means that applications sit, unless they're pregnant or some of those priorities, sit and wait for the workers to actually get time to do them. Our technology, we'd love to have better technology, because probably our office is one of the least technical. We don't have the computers that some other offices do and the way to check things. If we get some of the technology that we're using as image applications, that would help the workers do faster. We're also trying to put more into the investigations part, where we're getting more screens, like the investigative unit has more things they can check. So, it's you get a case, and how do you decide whether, do I check more on this case or not, or is there something that doesn't make sense? And so it's really the worker's instinct. So besides technology and having more time to process the applications, but then you've got people waiting to get medical that might, they're very customer-oriented, because they're the ones getting the frontline calls to say, hey, look, I've got this emergency medical thing going on, and, I'm dying of cancer, or I'm dying of this, or my kid. So they have to determine that emergency. So I don't think I'm a lot of help. It is. It's very frustrating.
Thank you, Chair Carter. What's interesting to me as well is when you look at the personal financial information that's requested, you only look at one part of the financial statements, and that's the asset and the income side. There's no discussion about the liability section of a person's financial statement.
Madam Chair and Senator Smith, Representative Smith, you mean like what their bills are?
Yeah.
We have another form that we use if there's a question about, they say they have zero income. We want to know how they make their basic needs, like are they living with somebody, how they meeting their basic needs. So that's another form that we'll send them and pend it if we have that question about it. Mm. But we don't really care what their expenses are, except to trigger us. If you got expenses and you're paying it and you're not have shutoff notice, and that would trigger us. You got to have some income, or somebody's paying it.
Right.
So it's that kind of, questions that we do. And oftentimes we'll just pick up the phone and call them. Or if it's out in a rural area like you're talking about, we'll pick up the local branch and ask them to make a visit for us. So that's why we have connections with all the field offices. And we're actually structured so that one team services a certain area, so we get familiar with the resources and the workers and so on, the plans and so on and so forth in that area.
Thank you.
So.
Mm, sure.
Please, Dr. Bates.
If you would be kind enough to write down a list of things you think might improve our ability to screen people and be more efficient, I would really appreciate that. And it might be things like field offices should be determining eligibility face-to-face. It might include things like increased technology, exactly what you need in that technology, why you don't have access to screens that other agencies do that could be quickly done, and maybe requirements to show W-2 what income has been. And then I know you have federal laws involved in this that block you a lot of times from doing things. But if you could have specific things to bring to us, I would really appreciate that, both for this committee and for the audit committee.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Bates, we can get that for you.
Thank you.
Glad to.
Thank you again. One observation I have in regards to that on the income under the checking account and savings account, you just ask for the account number. If a financial institution and a method of contact was included in that, one screen you would have to determine income eligibility could be taken care of there, because chances are a person who is not traditionally going to qualify for the income portion of it is going to have a checking account or a savings account, and a call to the financial institution could give you a very regular or very accurate picture of the regular deposits that are made to those accounts. But again, I don't know how much time you have to do that. So,
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, an application itself takes on an average of about, a worker probably could do maybe 2 an hour. And as far as a call to a bank won't give us that information without a release. We have to go to the client first to get the information about bank accounts.
With all due fairness, Chair, you could, and again, it's probably more of a time issue than a policy issue, because you could put one statement on here that authorizes whoever you prefer.
Yeah, we have done. We have
access
used
to
that.
Any and all information. But you're right. Chances are Wells Fargo is not going to want to take the time to verify that information.
Madam Chair, the department is responsive to any suggestions for improving the process that come from the legislature or from direction from the legislature or input from the public or from other parts of the department. So we're always trying to improve the process.
Is this the end of your report?
Yes.
End of your report?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the collaboration and the help we get. This really concludes our presentation of the health services programs. And we've just, I'm amazed at how these things always fit into the right amount of time. I just, a couple of comments. I'm really sorry that Senator Morse had to leave the room because he asked one of the more important questions, I think, about what's the future look like? And when I think about the demographic changes that we're facing and how they influence the cost of care and how much of the cost of health care is really born in the later stages of life, and how many of the costs we bear have to do with the behaviors that we indulge in as a society, whether it's diet or the risks we take physically or with injuries or whatever. And I wanted to take this opportunity to say that we spend most of our time thinking about providing care to people who need it, but we also ought to be thinking about prevention, because we are in a race between prevention and bankruptcy here. And the faster that we can focus on how to prevent people from getting sick, to lead healthier lifestyles, and I know as a state employee I have insurance through the state program. I get something every 3 or 4 days urging me to keep myself healthy, to improve my diet, to take fewer risks. I know the legislature is looking at some helmet bills for kids, for example. Those are the kinds of things that we can control. We hope that we will live longer lives. We know that there's costs there. We know there will be medical inflation. But that part of the budget that we pay the least attention to holds probably the most promise for really addressing this. And I hope that we've spanned that whole spectrum, beginning with public health and the prevention aspects, through behavioral health and what lies there to this very expensive and important health care sector. And this department is involved at every step of the lives of Oregonians, and I think health services really illustrates that as much as any part of the department. So we will return on Thursday to answer the literally dozens of questions you've posed, and I hope that that information will round out the picture for you.
Actually, Barry, you said it well, and so maybe we can encapsulate the comments that you made in terms of prevention, because that's exactly where I am in terms of how we can, as a society, do a better job monitoring our health and our own personal welfare. That's very important. So thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow, if not Thursday.
Madam Chair, we have public testimony scheduled for tomorrow.
Okay, so we'll see you.
We will be here tomorrow.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.